gather round. I'm glad everybody came out tonight. As we stand on our neighborhood corner, know that this fire that's burning represents the passion you have. Listen. I recognize all of you. Every creed and color. With that being said,
We had!
Say what?
Ways.
Now beat that.
Oh yeah!
Now what we want you all to do is sit back, y'all. And just relax, y'all. Sit back, y'all. Just relax, y'all. Sit back, y'all. And just relax, y'all. And if you dig it, let me hear your finger snap, y'all.
Now before I finish, let me just say, I did not come here to show out. Did not come here to impress you. Because to tell you the truth, when I leave here, I'm gone. And I don't care what you think about me. But just remember, when it hits the fan, brother, whether it's next year, 10 years, 20 years from now, you'll never be able to say that these brothers lied to you, Jack.
Okay, I'll reload it.
From the sports bars to the stands, we are the voice of the fans. You are now plugged in to the Section 357 show, a.k.a. the Ball Street Journal. And you have my man, Big Shot Ron, sitting in with yours truly, Floyd. Ron, how you doing, man?
I'm doing good, man. You know, summertime edition of the show. We are now full swing into the NBA offseason. So even though it's kind of referred to as the dog days of summer, you know, we still got a lot to talk about, review this draft, and talk about some of the things that are coming forth in the league. But let's get right to it, man. How you doing? How's everything out there on Danny Pace's Ferry, or as it used to be called, Danny Pace's Ferry? Man, how's everything with you?
Feeling good. Feeling great, man. Cannot complain. You talk about the street, formerly known as Danny Pace's Ferry Road. Things are pretty good down here, man. I mean, there's a lot of change in Atlanta right now as it relates to the Hawks. New ownership group, new organizational structure with Coach Bud going from just coach to now team president, if you will. So there's a lot of change in the air. And it's interesting as you talk about sort of those changes happening with the Hawks. The Hawks were one of those teams in the NBA draft that kind of got, I would call it, an incomplete grade, if you will. The draft is a time where there's lots of hope and big dreams for the future, and the Hawks kind of punted, if you will, to borrow a football term. So we can get into some of that, but I wanted to get your thoughts, Big Shot Ron, on the NBA draft, and what was your general interpretation, what were your general thoughts on the tenor of this year's NBA draft, whether it be the players themselves, the kind of players who were getting chosen with those higher draft picks, and maybe some of the other moves that you think may start to begin a domino process for some of these teams out here?
Well, I think this draft, you know, I think the one thing that, you know, fans like you and I who came up when the draft during the 80s and the 90s was like an event, is there was no real star. You know, there was no surefire Hall of Famer, multiple-time All-Star in this draft. A lot of what you would call really good players. A lot of guys who play a lot of different positions. And I think in the NBA, which is moving to this league of multi-positions, you know, no one's really shoehorned into a certain spot. I think a lot of teams did well. They may not be guys that you know a lot about, maybe not guys who are headed to Springfield, Massachusetts, but guys who I think can step in and fill a lot of different spaces. So I think overall it was a good draft, but I think it's if you were looking for big names and excitement, it might not have fill your appetite like you want it.
You know, Ron, I think the age of social media has also impacted the draft as it relates to the draft coverage, because as many folks on Twitter remarked, there were tweets being sent out about draft picks before they were getting announced on the broadcast. And if you want the broadcast to remain an integral part of the experience, the NBA, and I would even say the NFL, has to do more to kind of tighten up that loophole, if you will, the communications loophole. Because you can just follow along on Twitter, you know, with emphasizing a couple of key Twitter accounts there, and between your Adrian Wojnarowski and a couple other folks, you're pretty good on what's happening during the NBA draft without having to actually watch the broadcast.
Floyd, you're someone who in your 9-to-5, you cover arts, media, you know, social media platforms. If you are Adam Silver or Roger Goodell as well, do we almost have to go with, look, when you get to the draft, we need to check your cell phone and put your cell phone in the bin at the door? Does there need to be a memo that needs to go out to all NBA teams, NFL teams, that says, look, you cannot release this pick before television does? Because obviously this is part of your ESPN package, one of your broadcast partners who is paying a nice penny for this. And as you're saying, it's almost defeating the purpose of television, period, in this era where you can just go on Twitter and find this out minutes before it actually happens.
You know, Ron, I think there's one of two ways to handle this. Either you lock it down the way that Beyonce locks down who's working on her albums, and there's generally, you know, no leaks at all. You go top secret Beyonce status in terms of locking it down, or you go all in. That means instead of having these guys in a position to leak information, make those guys part of the broadcast. Set up some sort of area where it's not quite the war room, but maybe it's the social media room or the Twitter hub, if you will. Whatever the case has to be, you maybe make these guys part of the broadcast so that you're not getting scooped by them, or I would say your on-air announcers aren't getting scooped by the guys on Twitter. That way you can fully invest in the experience. Maybe you pull in a couple of other apps like Periscope, which is a streaming app, a video streaming app for Twitter. So, you know, I think you got to adapt to the times. And I'm not sure if the NBA nor the NFL is keeping up with the rapid changes of social media as it relates to communication around their draft broadcast and the whole draft process.
And it does take away from television coverage. You know, I was a person who, you know, I tried to not have my phone next to me during the draft coverage so I could get that live experience. And then you look on, you know, a Facebook just kind of intermittently checking it, or Twitter, and you see three picks ahead. And I think it's something the NFL and the NBA certainly have to be conscious of, because it does kill your coverage, and it kill your coverage. It makes your people look bad, because now they're talking, they're behind. You know, trades are getting announced 10 minutes later that we've already known is going to happen. So I think they do got to tighten that coverage up. Now, let me ask you this, Floyd. You are obviously ATL resident, born and raised. Are you okay? The Hawks obviously had a really good year. I mean, the ending was not good, obviously, but a 61-year when it's going good, they play a really nice, attractive style of ball. You talk about the focus on the team. As an ATL fan and an observer of ATL culture, let me ask you something. You've come from a town that had three of the biggest stars ever to play in their respective sport. And I'm not saying like greatest of all time. I'm just talking about the star power. When you talk about Mike Vick, Dominique Wilkins, Deion Sanders. Three of the biggest personalities and stars their respective sports have ever seen. And this Hawk team
is definition of team. There's not one guy who's the big shining personality, the guy whose name's up in lights. As a consumer and as a fan, if the Hawks do not grab a megastar and they just continue to build this very Spurs-like situation, for you, is that okay?
To be honest, Ron, I must admit that this past NBA season made me more okay with that than I probably would have been had they won 50 games with this same crew and not 60. Maybe I would feel differently, but I've resigned myself to understanding that the Hawks have a certain culture that they want to facilitate, and that's just the way they're going to approach it. Would I like to have a transcendent player here? I mean, of course, any fan base would, but I think that they have realized that there are only a handful of really ultra-magnetic superstar players around. And if you don't have one of those players, do you A, kind of sit back and complain and hope that you can acquire one, or do you B, change the structure of your team? So I think from the stance of there's just not a lot of star power to go around, this is the best way to go about it after that. So, you know, I'm kind of resigned to that fact, although in my heart of hearts, you want to be able to have that emotional investment in that big star player. From the Hawks' perspective, though, I think my concern is that, to borrow from the Atlanta Falcons season, you know, the Atlanta Falcons went 13-3 a few years back, and everybody around town felt like that 13-3 really wasn't 13-3. It was more like a 10-win season where you kind of caught some breaks in three of those games. And a lot of us are looking at the Hawks and trying to figure out, was last year's 60-win team really a 60-win team, and will they fall back down to maybe a 50-win team this year? So, you know, all bets are off in the playoffs anyway, but I think that we are trying to sort of figure out what this team really is as sort of a second act to last year's great, great run.
Yeah, I think from a Chicago perspective, this offseason, I think the business of the Chicago Bulls offseason honestly was done already. I think firing Tom Thibodeau was the big move of the offseason. And I think right now this is a team that is very much in a transitional stage. We draft Bobby Portis, so now we pretty much have four power forwards on the team. So now the question is are they able to move a Taj Gibson, a Joakim Noah? One of the countdowns that's already started in Chicago is that now we're 2 years off of Derrick Rose's free agency. And I think that's going to be a very interesting situation, even though it's 2 years down the line, that a lot of people are already preparing for. So from a Chicago view, I think this offseason is very much a transitional situation as far as getting this roster more turned over. But speaking of the draft, Roy, you've lived in London. You traveled abroad. It leads us to the curious case of Emmanuel Mudiay. He was a high school star in Dallas. Went to Deion Sanders School, prime prep. Could be some eligibility issues. He's supposed to go to SMU. He never goes. He ends up going to China. He gets drafted number 7 overall. Not necessarily about Emmanuel Mudiay, but what do you think about the high school to overseas path? It's not been done that many times. We talked about in a pre-show meeting Brandon Jennings. Jeremy Tyler tried it a couple years ago, didn't really work out. So it hasn't been done too many times. Do you think this is a viable option for your elite of elite high school players, or is this still, you know, spend that year at Chapel Hill, at Duke, at Arizona, at Michigan State, and then try your luck? Or is the overseas path something you think is more open now?
All right. Let me attach my answer to your question to the sort of system that Coach Cal has at Kentucky. So if you're telling me that from now until the system gets changed, Kentucky will have a parade of one-and-done players who stay 1 year, maybe two years, and then go pro. This past year's NBA draft, Kentucky had 5 players drafted, if I'm not mistaken. So you have some one-and-done players there. What is the difference? What is the real legitimate difference between a player knowingly going to Kentucky to stay 1 year and getting drafted, and a player knowingly going overseas to play ball 1 year, knowing he's going to go get drafted, and with the extra incentive of a $1 million contract? Emmanuel Mudiay was a millionaire, so to speak, before he even got drafted into the NBA. Signed a $1.2 million contract. So what is the real risk here for players to really go overseas rather than going to Kentucky for a year or do 4 years? What is the real risk? You look at the alternative of making money and then still getting the same amount of attention, the same, you know, draft look that you would get had you gone to Kentucky. I'm very much about players, being empowered to make informed decisions. And if you're telling me that a guy can go to Kentucky and not get paid, whereas the school makes lots of money off of them and then goes into the NBA draft, or a player can go to China or wherever else, Italy, it doesn't matter, go get paid, and then come back to that same draft a year later, I mean, what's the better alternative? I mean, I'm just more interested in how many other players begin to investigate the Emmanuel Mudiay / Brandon Jennings route.
Well, I think it's interesting because if you look at their two situations, both situations were sort of spun off of a potential eligibility issue. I think what will be interesting is to see who doesn't have that issue and goes anyway. So I think what you're looking for is who that one guy who decides, you know what, I'm just not going to go into college. Brandon Jennings and Mudiay both, this was kind of a second option. I think what the NCAA fears is if this becomes now a primary option, where if a guy says, you know something, yeah, I got the ACT score, the SAT score, I'm all good there, but I just do not want to go to Duke, or I do not want to go to Kentucky, and I want to go to Spain, I want to go to Greece and make some money and get ready. Because the reality is, especially if you go to a league like Spain is basically considered the second best league in the world after the NBA. So if a guy says, like, I can go get the next best level of competition and get myself ready for the NBA, make $1 million, $1.5 million, or even if I can make high five figures, that's certainly a better option than sitting in the dorm, you know, eating out the cafeteria. So what I think the NCAA is going to have to be able to respond to, now they've said guys can put their name in a draft if they want and can take their name out, I think the NCAA and the NBA are going to have to either partner to find a better way of making that transition. Otherwise, there will be somebody in the near future who just totally eschews the college option.
Yeah, and I think that what it might boil down to is the family situation of the player, the maturity of the player, obviously, and the information that they're afforded. Because these European teams or even teams in China, I'm not sure how much inroads they've made into the AAU circuit or to the general high school basketball circuit. Because right now, it's still pretty much, hey, you're the best, eighth grader in your state. Then you get recruited kind of, so to speak, you know, a nod and a wink to come to a certain high school to go play ball. Maybe you switch high schools a couple different times. But once you're in high school, the letters start coming from a Coach K, a Coach Cal, Michigan. You start to get these early recruiting what a correspondence is, and like it's a process. So the NCAA or the schools in college ball, in college hoops, can work on these guys for 3 or 4 years to get them to come. It's do the professional teams overseas have as much time and energy to commit to that same type of process? So once there's more information for families, and for the students, the high school students themselves, it's, you know, now you're making a choice based on controlling your economic future rather than the NCAA's rules. Because if you are eligible, let's say you pass all of your tests and everything, you are eligible, you go play overseas for a year, make $1 million, you can go pay for your college education after that if you don't make it, right? So where's the downside?
Right, and I think this is going to be the next step. And I think this is why the NCAA, NBA, AAU relationship has to get figured out how they do this, because I think if you look at now, the only thing that stops European teams really from coming over to look at high school kids, that pretty much it's an NCAA rule that now NBA personnel can no longer be in a lot of these high school summer circuit programs. However, there is a NBA Players Association run camp. It's called NBPA Top 100, which is a Player Association run camp. Now, the Players Association could vote and say, hey, we're going to allow European club scouts to look at this camp. And the top 100 players in the country are here. So I think you're going to see, it'll be interesting to see if somebody pushes this. I know Thon Maker, who's the 7-foot African kid who will be a senior in high school this year, but everyone pretty much considers like the best young player in the world, how his goes, because he's someone who it's pretty much assumed he will never set foot on a college campus. And I think he's somebody who I think you could see push it next year where he goes over to Europe to play. So I just think it's headed that direction. As you talk about Floyd, players have too much information now. Now, this is not like in the 80s and the 90s where you went to Old State U and that's how it was done. In this era, man, players know too much about how this process works. They've been recruited, as you talked about, since they were in grade. They know how that process works, too. So I think it's only a matter of time before I think Europe becomes that option. And players will skirt the rules. You know, if you saw the Sonny Vaccaro special on ESPN, a guy like Sonny Vaccaro will set up a workout for you. He'll put you in touch with an agent. He'll put you in touch with the shoe company. So you might as well figure this out now formally, because the players themselves will figure this out eventually.
Going to the draft specifically, I think I might have misspoken earlier and said Kentucky had 5 guys drafted. I believe it was 6 guys drafted, if I'm not mistaken. But going back to the draft, Big Shot Ron, I feel like outside of the top 10 in the NBA draft these days, after the top 10, it's fairly, you know, it's 50-50. It's a crapshoot on whether the guys are going to really pan out or not. What are your thoughts on the guys who were drafted? Who do you think is going to be the best pro player out of this draft class?
Well, I'm going to say the best pro player outside of Karl Anthony Towns. I think, well, I'm not going to go as far as some people said Hall of Fame great, multiple time also. I think he's clearly the best player in this draft. The guy that I really like, though, the guy who I really think is going to be a really, really good NBA player, I think it's Sam Decker with Houston. I think sometimes your draft, your situation is a combination of where you get drafted. And I think even though he's number 18 pick, he's going to a situation that fits his game really well. Houston spreads the floor. You know, they let the guys, the bigger guys can handle the ball. He can do a lot of different things. He's somebody I really like, even though he was drafted lower. I think D'Angelo Russell
going to the Lakers is a great pick. You know, I know the Lakers have always been stuck on, we need that big man, we need that big man. But I think picking Russell was a great pick. I think he's got a little bit, maybe not quite the score, but there's a little bit of James Harden, left-handed, very tricky with the dribble. Somebody could take that ball handling load off of Kobe, or hopefully Kobe will allow him to do that. So I think those two guys have really good situations working for them.
And Ron, one thing about the NBA draft that is different from the NFL draft is, one, of course, you have many more rounds in the NFL draft, but you're also drafting for very specific positional needs and different positional roles on an NFL team. Whereas in the NBA, you know, you got the same five guys playing offense and defense all at once. And to me, I always feel like the media oversells the impact that these players are going to have. The vast majority of guys drafted in an NBA draft, and even really the NFL also, most of these guys are going to just be guys, right? I mean, and we never know who's going to be the next superstar, but just from a numbers game, most of these draft guys are going to just be, you know, guys to fill out rosters. May crack a starting rotation here and there. But when you look at sort of the hierarchy of the NBA, we've already eliminated most of the second round draftees by default, right? Whereas in the NFL, yeah, a lot more value comes in those later rounds.
Right. I think you look at the NBA, it is very much your goal state. You have to put together multiple drafts. We did the article, you know, for our website about Golden State, Oklahoma City. That took four or five drafts before you put together a team. It is very rare that one guy changes your fortune overnight. Very rare. I think there was even a stat on ESPN. I think they said since, in the last 20 years, only like 10 guys who were drafted in the lottery have won a title. So it's very difficult for one man. Like you're talking the Jordans, the Magics of the world, where a guy can step in day one and turn a team around. As great as Anthony Davis is and is going to be, he just made the playoffs for the first time this year as a number 8 seed. So this is not something that is done overnight. So it does take a couple of drafts to get this right, because as you say, you have to have a guy who does both, who can play both ends. It's piece building. Like, this is a science to this, and so many teams don't get this science right. Other thing you could look at, Floyd, is look at how the all-star teams now have not gotten younger. You know, you don't see a many guys in like year one or year two make an all-star team. Anthony Davis just made one this year, but again, he's not the exception. You know, it's still very much about that growth and development, and even your best players need 3, 4, 5 years before they hit that level.
And going back to Golden State, since you mentioned the article, I wanted to ask you about the way in which Golden State has developed over the past few years, because I would contend that you rarely see a group of guys just get better from year to year. Most of the time in the NBA, you have guys who are what they are, and they have that skill set or the same skill set for the duration of their careers. But rarely do you see a group of guys who just seem to get better together. And I think that's what we saw with Golden State. Can you speak to that a little bit?
To me, Floyd, that conversation right there is what got lost a lot. And a lot of the focus is LeBron James, fourth loss in the finals. But what got lost was how unique that Golden State team was. You're talking, they drafted four of their five starters on a championship team with Curry, Green, Klay Thompson, Harrison Barnes. It is rare. I mean, you would probably have to honestly go back to the 80s to find a team that drafted in almost an entire starting lineup and won a championship. And that is a credit to their front office. You know, whoever is their trainers, their player development guys, that they drafted four guys to start for a title winner. And not only were they like a title winner, Floyd, they were a historically great team. We talk about number one offense, number one defense, 83 wins. This is one of the best, one of the great single seasons we've ever seen. So they definitely were unique. And I think it was a unique accomplishment because you're doing it with a 6'3 guy as your best player. You're doing it with starting a 6'6 center. You're doing it with 6'8, 6'7 guys who could play everything. So they were probably the most uniquely put together team we've seen in a while. And I think that speaks back to your article, sort of the shame of what happened with Oklahoma City, is that when you put a team together like that through the draft, you know, Oklahoma City, as detailed by you, Westbrook, Harden, Durant, Ibaka, and if you want to count Jeff Green, they drafted a starting lineup, basically. But for business reasons or whatever, they never gave it a chance to give it another year or two before they destroyed it. So I think when you have something that's unique and built, that's why you have to hold on to it as long as you can, because it just does not happen that often.
And I think when it comes to the Warriors and their chances going forward for continued success, you can never guarantee championships, but you have to give your teams a chance to be in that conversation. And I believe that with Curry and Thompson, who didn't really have a great finals, and Draymond Green, who I'm sure they'll try to find a way to keep, you know, those three guys together for quite some time, throwing in Harrison Barnes, you see a group of young guys who made themselves better players from year to year to year. And I'm not sure, you know, how much credit you want to give to Mark Jackson in that terms of, you know, maturity. I'm not sure if they want to kind of give most of the credit to Steve Kerr for kind of pulling the right strings there. But all of the factors involved in that, I think, are important, whether it was drafting the right guys, Mark Jackson as a coach, Steve Kerr, the right addition of Andre Iguodala. But I think that the Warriors showed that if you have a group of talented guys, maybe not all world talent, maybe not LeBron James, Magic Johnson level talent, but if you have, you know, a lot of guys who are talented at the right time together, you can make some really good things happen.
I think it also, what it does, Floyd, and you know this, you talk about bigger picture, this now puts you at the conversation if you want to go after Kevin Durant, if you want to go after Russell Westbrook, or whatever big-time elite free agent comes up years, because now you've got the championship banner, you developed this team, you know, you got some pretty friendly contracts. Like Steph Curry, I think, has three more years on his first extension. He's only getting paid like $10, $11 million a year. You know, you were on national TV, so people saw the passion for the Warriors. You talked about in our conversation in the new arena in San Francisco, I think, in what, 2 years? So by doing it this way, they've put themselves on that upper echelon of franchise where now you are a destination spot now. You know, Golden State is no longer the fifth option for a free agent. Now guys look at you as a destination spot to go to.
I think Golden State was in many ways a sleeping giant when it comes to NBA royalty. You know, it's not the Lakers, it's not the Celtics, you know, it's not the history of the Sixers, you know, going back, or, you know, the recent history of, you know, the Rockets, you know, from the Olajuwon days. But I think that when you look at Golden State, they have
a cool nickname. They got good colors. They have a passionate fan base. And they have an area of the state that supports them. So they're pulling from Oakland as well as San Fran, and really as well as, you know, the full Bay Area. And I think all of those things put together makes Golden State an attractive place to play, because Golden State isn't an uncool place to be. Living in San Fran or the nice parts of Oakland is not an unattractive place to want to live. Like, you have a lot of things going for you being in that Golden State Warriors community there.
Certainly, and you know, you traveled there and seen it. It's a pretty, you know, the Bay Area, even as much as, you know, we talk about the Oakland side of it, even Oakland has some real contemporary sides to it. We know what San Francisco's like. We talked about the personality of a team. Not only were they a really good team, they were a fun team to watch. They seemed to be a team that was very likable and enjoyable. So if a guy looking to change teams, cool city, the cool colors, a new arena, the guys on the team are pretty cool, and they got the championship. And that championship cachet gets you in the conversation. You look at a city like Miami. Now, different city. Once Miami won that first title, pretty much since they've been in the conversation pretty much for the last 10 years with every big name, because you add the city, atmosphere, plus championship, you get to go to the table. And now Golden State gets to be at the table. So now definitely guys will consider it, because it not only has the lifestyle that you want, it's got the basketball too.
Big shot, Ron. As we wrap up, looking at NBA free agency, looking at the NBA draft, and sort of looking at the finals, you know, looking back at the NBA finals, one of the things I'm curious about is, going forward, how will the big-time stars of this league continue to treat free agency? You talk about guys signing short-term contracts to kind of manage their leverage over a team like a LeBron. You talk about guys having chances to opt out earlier in their contracts. Do you think that we're heading into an era where you see more guys taking it year to year to make sure that they can exercise as much player control over the league as possible?
I think this is where this is going, because remember with the last lockout, the owners wanted out of those big max Joe Johnson contracts. They didn't want the 6-7 year max deal anymore. But when they said they didn't want that, you've now sacrificed player movement. You have player movement and player control. And Floyd, you worked freelance before, and how this works, you go to the next best gig or the next best paying gig. So I think this becomes a negotiating tour. If you're the Players Association, when the next CBA comes up, you can give us back those max contracts, or you're going to continue to just have constant team turnover, because guys are going to look at this now as being an independent contractor. I'll stay here 3 years, but give me that third year as a player option. If it doesn't work out in 2 years, I'm out. And I think it puts more pressure on GMs and coaches to get it right, because if you're going to give the player that much control of movement, every 2 or 3 years, you're changing the team. I guess, let me just fire it back at you. If you were a player or a player's agent, which would you rather have? Would you rather have the long-term contract of a max, that Joe Johnson deal, or would you rather have the ability to just leave, to pretty much leave whenever you want to, or leave after 2 years?
I think it boils down to who the player is, because a player like LeBron or even a Kevin Durant, as he goes into his contract situation on the horizon here, you have the ability to make max money for whatever the contractual stipulations allow for whenever you sign your name to a contract. So you're going to make your money. you know, whether it's a series of short-term deals or one long-term deal, you're going to get your money. I think it's those second-tier and even third-tier guys who are probably angling for more long-term security. But I think that with the top-level guys leveraging as much player control as they can while they have it, I think that's a good thing for the NBA. You know, we like to throw shade at players for a lot of things, but I think that this era of players is probably more financially savvy, or I guess business savvy, as any generation of players that we've seen as it relates to managing the machine of their league. So I'm excited to see more players strategize around how they want to go about their deals and get what's best for them. So closer to the average players, if you will, you know, kind of just your eighth, ninth man on the roster, those guys will always kind of fill in wherever they can and try to take as much as they can whenever they can get it. But I like to see the top guys, for the time that they have that power, exercise it as many ways as possible.
Yeah, I think today's player is so much more keenly aware of the business than the players of 20, 25 years ago. I think, yes, they want to win. They want championships. There's no question about it. But I think this era of player understands control of career a lot better than their predecessors. And like you said, there's nothing wrong with that. Because to me, if you look at real life, we all look for jobs and look to move and change our life situation and change our career arc and path every day. So why would a professional athlete not be able to do the same thing that the teacher, the janitor, the IT guy, the consultant does every day? I mean, it is about controlling your career. And certainly these guys are much more aware of how this is done. And I think that's what's going to make this next CBA interesting, is that do the owners give some of that back? And if they decide not to give it back, will you see players, the constant movement, the constant turnover with these different rosters? Because, you know, hey, you could get a guy no longer held to being the good soldier for 8-9 years. Now in 2 years, if I don't like this job, hey, I'm out. So it's going to be a very interesting give and take with this next deal.
Big shot, Ron, as we wrap up, I want to ask you about NBA royalty. You talk about the Lakers not being in the playoffs, the Sixers falling on hard times, the Pistons falling on hard times, the Knicks most definitely falling on hard times. Which of those teams, you know, the sort of NBA royalty, if you will, which of those teams bounces back first, given where they are right now?
I say, despite being in the tougher conference, despite the fact that they have to share a building with the Clippers, who have, you know, turned it around, I still believe the Lakers will be the first of that group to turn it around. The Laker name, the purple and gold, Jack, the Lakers still have real, real big-time cachet. And I think it's just a matter of which star will take their money. You know, we've heard the rumors of DeMarcus Cousins. Russell Westbrook, a free agent soon. Kevin Love might be a guy who re-signs with Cleveland but takes that shorter deal. Supposedly, they're in for LaMarcus Aldridge. The Lakers will always have a seat at the table for any elite free agent. So I think they're first. I think Boston, I think the Knicks and 76ers will be their last. The 76ers, I think, honestly, Floyd, and this is something that you and I may have to talk about, I think they are as close to committing a fraud on basketball as I've seen. I think what they're doing is terrible. And I think just collecting these draft picks and stashing guys overseas and playing a roster of minimum pay dudes, I think that whole situation, I think, is something that we're going to start to hear more and more about over the next season and seasons to come. I think what they're doing is terrible. The Knicks is just a badly constructed roster. And I don't wonder if they do not have buyer's remorse on giving Carmelo Anthony all that money with the roster that was in that shape.
Well, there it is. This has been another episode of the Section 357 show here with Big Shot Ron and myself, Floyd. You can always find us online at section357.com. Find us on Twitter at section357. And you can always find us and find past episodes of the podcast on iTunes, on Podomatic, as well as Stitcher. With that being said, good luck to you and your favorite teams out there, wherever you might be. This has been the Section 357 show. Until next time, take care.